Have you ever wondered why some people sacrifice everything for art? Something with little obvious practical value? This question launched journalist Bianca Bosker on an extraordinary adventure into the secretive art world, transforming not just her understanding of art, but her entire perception of reality. What began as curiosity about why artists described making art as essential as life or fucking death became a journey that fundamentally altered how she experienced the world around her. Through immersive experiences, working in galleries, guarding museum pieces, and assisting renowned artists, Bosker discovered that art isn't just something to be understood intellectually. It's a powerful tool for experiencing a richer, more vibrant existence in a culture where visual literacy has never been more crucial, yet traditional art institutions struggle to remain relevant. My entry into New York's exclusive art scene began when Jack Barrett, owner of a small but respected Brooklyn gallery, took me under his wing despite my self-confessed status as a normie Philistine. Located above hair-braiding salons in gentrifying downtown Brooklyn, Jack's gallery featured bewildering works like animatronic self-bashing drum sets and wearable shrines made of antlers and marshmallows. As I stared blankly at a gold and black wall drawing, my mind remained empty, exactly the type of art I desperately wanted to comprehend but couldn't. Jack addressed my art world naivety by assigning films, essays, and art theory, insisting I needed to understand object-oriented ontology to properly discuss contemporary art. The gallery world had its peculiar codes. Jack obsessed over 4,500 Kelvin lighting and pristine walls while critiquing my appearance. I observed successful art people speaking in effectless murmurs. My eventual adaptation earned me a gallery key and the title of assistant. September in New York revealed the art ecosystem, primary versus secondary market, pure versus commercial galleries, with New York as the epicenter. Location mattered. Downtown for emerging artists, Chelsea for established names, Upper East Side for the famous dead. At openings, networking overshadowed art appreciation. Everyone tracked important figures and traded gossip. I struggled to connect with the provocative works. To develop my eye, I received contradictory advice. Some claimed it was innate, others said there were no wrong answers. The solution was simple: see more art. I visited artists in their studios across the city, finding them above auto shops and in cramped apartments, all working second jobs to sustain their practice. In the art world, I learned that context was a tangible currency. An artwork's value wasn't just about aesthetics. It encompassed the artist's education, exhibition history, critical reception, collectors, influences, and even social media presence. These details weren't peripheral, they were fundamental to understanding the work. This preoccupation with context permeated everything, from gallery staff practicing phone etiquettes to commissioned art histories and cultivated artist personas. Context even defined art itself, as demonstrated by Duchamp's urinal becoming sculpture through institutional validation. Jack grew increasingly frustrated with my presence, eventually expressing doubts about allowing me to observe the industry. "Information is power," he said, concerned that democratizing access might threaten the art world's carefully guarded exclusivity. The emerging art scene, despite its progressive appearance, maintained its own form of exclusivity, based on social capital rather than financial wealth. Access depended not just on buying power, but on being their type of person. After Jack's gallery, I joined Denny Dimon Gallery, which contrasted sharply with its street-level window and bustling atmosphere. While Jack favored provocative, conceptual art, Denny Dimon embraced beautiful work with conceptual depth. Elizabeth, unlike Jack, saw no conflict between artistic merit and commercial success, simply stating, "I just want the art to exist." As Julie Curtis's studio assistant, I discovered the physical demands of art making firsthand. Stretching massive canvases left my hands blistered, while Julie performed her daily dance with paint and sculpted hair. Working alongside her changed my perspective on paintings. Beyond meaning, I learned to see art's physical architecture, canvas tension, strategic material choices, oils for richness, acrylics for layering, and specialized brushes. From precise sable brushes to intentionally damaged ones creating signature effects, each tool served a purpose. Julie's relationship with her paintings was deeply personal. She treated them like willful children, each with distinct personalities. Some were very noisy and needed to face the wall, while others were pure suffering, resistant collaborators fighting her vision. The contrast between studio chaos and gallery presentation was striking. The ubiquitous white cube aesthetic, with its clinical lighting and pristine surfaces, has roots in Nazi cultural purification, yet endures because it effectively transforms ordinary objects into art through context. My breakthrough came when a physicist declared, "Most people think they see what is. They don't realize they see what they hallucinate." Meeting psychologist Rebecca Chamberlain revealed our visual system filters reality through expectations, while artists like Monet can override these default processes, accessing a less constrained way of seeing. This insight crystallized watching Julie mix gray paint for bathroom stalls. Instead of just black and white, she used 11 colors, including chrome orange, Naples yellow, and phthalo turquoise. When she pointed at her studio door's steel color, I finally understood. Where I saw gray, Julie saw an intricate dance of turquoise, orange, magenta, and periwinkle. She had transcended the filter of expectation to see the full spectrum hidden within gray. My relationship with color transformed. Though I'd previously dismissed color and stripped it from my apartment, artists like Julie, who had passionate affairs with certain hues, changed my perception. Ordinary walls became dazzling puzzles of orange highlights, lavender nooks, and blue shadows. The white walls of my apartment glowed pink at sunrise. Color evolved from visual input into pure joy. As a security guard at the Guggenheim Museum, I observed distinct visitor types: touchers craving contact, breathers exhaling on paintings, completers viewing methodically, and hunters seeking famous works. Most visitors spend just 17 seconds with artworks, four times less than they spend reading descriptions. My perspective shifted when I challenged myself to study single artworks for 40 minutes at each post. Constantine Brancusi's marble sculpture became transformative. What seemed initially pleasant but dull became a dynamic piece that changed daily, resembling everything from a trained seal to a boomerang. When the pandemic closed New York's art world, isolation led me to reflect. My relationship with art had evolved from skepticism to genuine curiosity. My tastes had shifted dramatically, drawn to the raw energy of emerging artists over curated museum experiences. I discovered that beauty isn't scarce, attention is. Beauty emerges when your mind jumps the curb and truly notices. Like dreams, which may prevent our brains from overfitting reality, art keeps our perception fresh by making the familiar strange. While our brains naturally compress reality, art transforms them from trash compactors into microscopes, enabling us to notice more and live more fully.